This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The last time on Dark Shining Moment, social media was flooded with disinformation. The real media was confronted with spectacle.
Well, it's not just to undermine one or support the other candidate, but to create some sort of a chaos, an image of that, you know, everybody is against everybody.
Conspiracy theory was no longer on the fringes, but was going mainstream.
And weird occult dinner parties where blood, semen, and breast milk are used in ritualistic ceremonies. No, this isn't a fake news story. It's absolutely real.
Yes, and sowing distrust in the media system, in the public institutions, it is heavily associated with conspiratorial thinking.
This is Dark Shining Moment, a Ranieri & Co. original podcast looking at how Russia interfered in America's election of 2016, disrupting its politics and helping to set in motion the crisis for democracy we see today. I'm Chris Sapone. To show you what happened in the aftermath of 2016, we actually have to go back a few years, back to 2012, in Eastern Europe. The time after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but before Russia's imperialism returns, which is to say, a good time to be traveling on the continent. There's a man named Ian. He's touring, he's on vacation, and he visits a historic site of mass atrocities. While he's there, he asks, aloud even, how such hate could have ever happened. Speaking to other tourists, someone points out a man, himself a tourist, who has some very strong views about the kind of loathing that occurred in Europe that allowed these sorts of atrocities. This older, heavyset man, with a kind of heaviness of demeanor, said that there were methods to getting people to hate as they did in the lead-up to World War II. In fact, the hate that allowed this atrocity was organized.
He tried to hammer home a few points here when he spoke about agitprop, for example, which I didn't really understand how agitprop was used.
Agitprop, a word that combines agitation with propaganda. The communists were famous for this.
He was adamant that I remember that the Nazis replicated their political warfare from Marxism.
As they spoke, the man tried to place Ian's accent. Are you English? No, Ian said.
When he realized I was actually not English, but from Northern Ireland, and I started talking about Northern Ireland, and he started talking about the Soviet role in Northern Ireland terrorism. Our conversation switched from discussing what the Nazis had did. He let rip the evils of Soviet communism. When he initially started to talk, I hadn't a clue about what he was talking about, some of the detail. Some of the terms he was using, I didn't really even know much about at the time.
This man told Ian in detail the kind of things that the Soviets had done in the 1970s and 80s in Europe, including in Northern Ireland.
I thought I knew a bit about terrorism and some of its mechanisms. He knew detail much, much more than anyone else I'd ever spoken to.
What was crucial was the use of front groups, groups that could be manipulated to take action that would further worsen and distort a political situation. The man talked about something he called Soviet gardening, where you water the weeds and you tear out the flowers. And you do that to a population. You basically tear down the people who are the moderates and the peacemakers, but you raise up the people who are the dividers and extremists. That's something we see today, everywhere. More on that in a bit.
That conversation happened in between the invasion of Georgia and activities in Syria and Ukraine. And when I started to notice some of the propaganda, the organized, targeted anti-Western narratives, the character assassinations, these were the sorts of things he had mentioned.
Ian had had some sense of this from his upbringing in Northern Ireland. It seemed inescapable. Following a cancer diagnosis in his family, Ian earlier had an interest in cancer research, specifically the imaging used to find cancer cells. As a lifelong tinkerer, he began to examine ways to speed up this imaging process.
And I had learned data skills to work around to find publications and papers on research topics. That was basic Google data mining, Boolean expression, and so forth. But it was quite an extensive bit of research back then. And I applied those to some of the front organizations and direct and indirect media of dictatorships, you could say.
Ian, who asked us not to use his surname, mapped out what he says is some of the first usable evidence of links between the authoritarian regimes and these groups in the UK and West. Then something happened. Just like how the ex-Soviet officer had described the tactics, they came roaring to life in the news. But this time, around the issue of potential intervention by the UK and US in the Syrian war. A groundswell of groups, often with radically different politics, mobilized to protest any Western action in Syria.
I strongly believe in the need for a tough response to the use of chemical weapons, but I also believe in respecting the will of this House of Commons. It is very clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly.
Here we have these front organizations acting in sync and lobbying and putting pressure on and trying to steer the direction of events. And then you have where David Cameron goes for the vote in Syria and loses that vote.
War and conflict was never preferable. But then neither was allowing Bashar al-Assad to embark on the systematic multi-year slaughter of the citizens of Syria. But that's what happened once it was clear that no one would intervene.
I'd noticed the rise of front groups and their activities, focused activities. These weren't random. These were anti-Western useful idiots, for want of a better word. Probably mostly unwitting. In fact, definitely mostly unwitting.
A useful idiot is someone who spreads propaganda for a cause without fully realizing it. They're useful to the people who want to sow hatred and instability. The man had told him.
For the useful idiots that see themselves as revolutionaries, hate is essential. Hate is absolutely essential.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace us!
That's two meanings, depending on... It can mean left to or down with. So...
Can we get a Mark Bar America?
We can get a Mark Bar America. Yes, we can. Mark Bar America!
Mark Bar America!
Mark Bar America!
Mark Bar America!
Black versus white, extreme left versus extreme right, Christian versus Muslim, Catholic versus Protestant. In too many cases, people think they're defending their country or community by protesting, but their anger can be co-opted in ways they don't fully understand. Ian watched the same clutch of groups over time. They advocated against Western action in Syria. They were against Ukraine's independence, but for Scottish independence. They supported Brexit. If you squinted, what their positions had in common was free passes for authoritarians, but opposition to Western power and unity. Finally, it came to the American election. With the groups being on the left, Ian expected a ferocious opposition to Donald Trump.
When it came to the run-up to the election, between the contest between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it was pretty clear from numerous indicators that these anti-Western activist media, who unsuspecting listeners and viewers may have expected them to really hate Trump, they were actually going after Hillary Clinton, and quite a clear pattern.
There was a variety of groups, but a consistency in message. Ian saw how these groups interacted. It brought to mind another thing the ex-Soviet told him, but which he didn't immediately understand. Ian recalls how this ex-Soviet man, so heavy and bearing, found a nearby twig as they spoke, and he drew a circle on the ground with it. Slowly, the man divided it up.
He was trying to use an example of a local dish, a meat pie, to describe how populations are targeted, any group, and harnessed and put to political use. So he talked about front organizations, obviously the anti-war ones which are written about. It was much more extensive. They would target any group and try and cultivate a group that they could put to use for political purposes and steer towards anti-Western narratives and agendas and so forth.
Cut up like a piece of pie, a different message for each group. But over time, the messages, if followed, led to cracks of division and disputes. In the end, as one was mobilized to turn on another, everyone became a useful idiot of sorts.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
After Trump won the election in the most divisive way possible, social trust was in tatters. Division and a kind of hysteria took hold of the media. But Russia's efforts to influence the U.S. didn't end there. In fact, they likely accelerated. To explain how, we need to take a look for a minute at something unique to the election and its aftermath: the perception, or fear, that Donald Trump had colluded with Russia. But to talk about that, we need to go to the moment right after he was elected. During the election and afterwards, signs of links between Trump and Russia were everywhere. Super spreader trolls, Americans, had posted about Trump, Russia, and Putin. Everything from the Twitter account Team Trump Russia to the public figures in Russia praising Trump. When Trump did win, it surprised everyone, the Russians included.
The State Duma, which is the lower house of parliament, when they heard that Hillary Clinton had conceded, they burst into applause. So it's clear that many here see this victory for Trump as a victory for Putin.
Australia's ambassador to Russia, Peter Tesh, was in Moscow at the time.
My memory, if it doesn't fail me, is of televised scenes of deputies in the Duma, the Russian parliament, rising to their feet and applauding when news reached them of the election of Donald Trump. Now, certainly it was the more extreme elements of the Russian Duma, but certainly amongst what you might call the elites, the political elites, the technocratic elites, the business elites, there was a distinct sense of, hey, this is breaking Russia's way.
Уважаемые коллеги, три минуты назад Хиллари Клинтон признала свое поражение на выборах президента Соединенных Штатов.
Russia, at a distance, may have helped Trump get elected by disrupting America's internal political processes, but that's not the same as the Kremlin controlling Trump. Here's Julia Yaffe, a Russian-speaking reporter who had been a target of the trolling in episode 4. Talking about Russia's reaction to Trump's win.
It's shock. They just thought they were going to bloody Clinton's nose. They didn't expect to break her neck. They didn't expect Trump to win.
Yaffe said the Russians immediately seized on the surprise, growing into our narrative of Moscow having installed our president.
Minor Russian politicians tweeting, "Trump is ours, America's ours, we got this."
Others saw it as well. Here's Tucker Carlson, of all people, speaking to a writer from the right-wing publication The Federalist in 2017.
If it really is a lie at its core, I mean, man, we spent an awful lot of time on this as a country.
Well, I think we need to distinguish between the claim that Trump colluded with Russia, but to say that Russia did have a propaganda that was designed to sow discord, I think there is something to that claim.
If people in the U.S. were prepared to believe Trump was a Russian tool, Russia was prepared to encourage that belief. After the Internet Research Agency's Evgeny Prigozhin was later indicted by the U.S., he said,
"Americans are very impressionable people. They see what they want to see. I have great respect for them. If they want to see the devil, let them see one.
In other words, if Americans saw Prigozhin or Putin or the IRA as puppet masters of U.S. affairs, then let them. These perceptions were a really powerful, useful notion for the Kremlin. And few countries do hysteria better than the U.S. Mingled with Trump's volatile style, the idea of Trump and Russia's collusion spread fear and doubt everywhere. After a cohesive narrative around the election shattered in the course of the campaign, the public was more suggestible than ever to conspiracy theories. Molly McHugh, a Russian information war expert who we heard from in episode 3, says Trump was an easy mark for the Kremlin, not as a collaborator, but as a kind of signpost they could bounce subversive messages off of.
For a long time, he had pursued the great Russian cash cow that other people had managed to get that he had not achieved, including when he had the Miss America pageant and was like, you know, hosting it in Russia and was like desperate to meet Putin and show Putin what a great guy he was. So there was this history that they knew could be exploited. And then Trump starts entering politics.
Even today, the question gets asked, did Russia's interference let Trump get elected? The reality is, interference is almost impossible to measure. For example, some credit WikiLeaks' massive October data leak of the Democrats' email as being consequential in helping Trump win. But if Trump hadn't gotten the nomination 3 months before, he wouldn't have been in a position to win. So in this way, possibly the more politically effective part of the interference came during the primaries. But suppose the interference made no difference. Still, the scale and sustained focus of the interference was astounding, destabilizing. And then, of course, it was followed by the election of an astounding, destabilizing president. With a cohesive, shared narrative for American politics decisively crushed by the chaotic election, the media, more networked than ever, tried to play catch-up on the causes of the disruption. Russian hackers, the Internet Research Agency, bots and trolls, a kind of feedback loop of panic set in for Trump, for Russia's meddling, for social media platforms.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
For Democrats, Trump was such a trespasser in the U.S. political world, it wasn't hard to imagine that the Kremlin had a direct connection to him. For Trump and his followers, the talk of Trump's supposed collusion with Russia was simply Democratic-fueled slander. It was enraging. And yet, somehow, there was always a fresh breadcrumb in the news that advanced the idea that Trump had been compromised. Somehow, the news cycle always brought information that provoked more suspicion and, more importantly, more division. You remember the P-tape, the prostitutes, and the money? Here's a former intelligence official discussing the dossier on Trump's alleged connections with Russians, which included these details, and which had been released just days before the election.
It attacked the process by saying that, you know, Trump was elected in spite of all this terrible stuff, and everybody was sitting on hiding it, and he's now in office, and he's in the pay of a foreign government. So from a strategic point of view, this report, if indeed it was originated from Russia, accomplished exactly what their strategic objective is in the international political arena.
That is, internal chaos and distrust within the U.S. For the Democrats, the dossier was near proof of Trump's collusion with Russia. For Republicans, its publication and dissemination was enraging.
I think it was disgraceful, that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do.
For the Republicans, the breadcrumbs were, if anything, proof of the government's complicity with the Clinton camp in maligning Trump. Or proof of the Clintons' use of slander to undermine Trump's legitimate, if controversial, victory. And as the months rolled by, that pattern continued.
The New York Times reports Trump's campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos, told the top Australian diplomat that Russia had thousands of emails incriminating Hillary Clinton.
Same breadcrumbs, radically different takeaways, but never anything definitely linking Russia to Trump. But there did seem to be a parade of small-time players, like energy consultant Carter Page.
Says, quote, the FBI believes that Carter Page has been collaborating and conspiring with the Russian government.
Jake, this is so ridiculous. It's just beyond words. It's literally a complete joke, and it only continues. It's just really sad.
In our new networked age, suspicion could easily outpace the facts.
Well, were you ever an agent of a foreign power? Did you ever advise?
For the audience, made up of Trump and his Republican supporters, these matters were evidence, not of the Kremlin's reach into U.S. politics, but of the hysteria on the part of the Democrats. It was the Russiagate hoax. Molly McHugh again.
This was a Russian effort to create this pattern of interaction with Donald Trump, and then at the same time, exposing that work. So making it known that they had these contacts, making sure that other information came out over time.
So to be clear, Russia, presumably through one or more of its intelligence agencies, sought and documented small, inconsequential interactions with Trump in a circle. Then they strategically publicized these interactions for effect. How hard would this be? How hard is it for someone to leak a small exclusive to a reporter? In society, as in social media, so much of the game of news is social, getting others to see what you see as newsworthy. Even better, how hard is it to use social media to amplify a particular, real news story? Not hard.
No matter which side you're on, any mention of any new element of any of this story, some new trial, you know, some new indictment, some old thing, like here's some new data we found, whatever it is, sets off both sides in this exact, you are managing the line of conflict in American society way that just makes me profoundly uncomfortable.
This isn't to say the division in the U.S. isn't real, but on this topic, Trump's relationship with Russia, perhaps there's a little curation going on. This theory helps explain how events in the real world could be used to paint the picture of increasing crisis and distrust on both sides. Consider the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower, where a Russian lawyer met with the Trump campaign.
We begin this hour with breaking news inside that now infamous Trump Tower meeting during the 2016 campaign. The meeting has been a key focus, as you well know, of the special counsel's investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Let's get to all
the Russians were seeking all these meetings. They were using a line of different contacts to get in to see him, to see people in his campaign. There was definitely an effort to either reach out to people in the campaign or to suggest people they already had connections and ties to join the campaign.
One day, a smoking gun of collusion could be found. Lord knows Trump's behavior towards Russia is strange enough. And it continues to this year's election.
NATO was busted until I came along. I said, everybody's going to pay. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, no, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay.
But so far, years after the event, it's still not there. I've read the stories. The pattern seems to be endless smoke, no real smoking guns.
So you have kind of the perception on one side is this, the perception on the other side is this. And now you have these two sides confronting each other in American society, believing they are both right. And that's just gotten worse over time.
A message for everyone. And the takeaway? A poisonous distrust for the other side.
So there were these patterns of interaction with what seemed like weird players, bit players, guys from the past, guys like Paul Manafort popping up again, guys like Michael Flynn, who should have known better, getting involved.
Manafort was convicted of tax and bank fraud, failure to file a report of a foreign bank, and obstruction. Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. Both Manafort and Flynn were later pardoned by Trump.
All of these sort of layers of people who had in the past shown themselves to be amenable to direct outreach to and from Russian intelligence. They had identified themselves as willing to cooperate with Russian efforts, and that made them targets when Russia was looking for people to fill the cast, essentially. If you have worked in countries around Russia, seen the patterns of Russian influence, been a target of any of their strange campaigns, you understand what they are willing to do to discredit a person, let alone to take apart a country, which I got to witness in Georgia in the election in 2013. And when you see the kinds of effort that they go to for these things, it is not small, it is not simple.
Many of the court convictions that arose from the Trump campaign had to do with lying to the government investigators. A serious crime, yes, but quite a bit different from collusion with a hostile foreign power.
It seems completely crazy to us that there's like all these different things, but you create the central story, which is we're going to do this. You know, we're going to back a political candidate in a U.S. election and then make it look like that's the thing and he's going to do stuff we want. Like, we're going to create this story. No matter what happens in the election, we have a stronger position for ourselves.
Liberal Russians warn that people in democracies assigning blame for internal division on external sources is a very Putin-like reaction. At the same time, the Kremlin, led by an ex-spy, has essentially consolidated power on the world stage by subversive means. This is a simple fact of the modern world.
The narrative has to be flexible, right? It has to be adaptive. If you're putting all of this money and effort into winning a U.S. election or influencing a U.S. election, however you want to define that goal, then no matter what the outcome is, it better be something that works for you.
And it was. In the final days of the campaign, when it appeared that Clinton would win, Russia had planned to question the fairness of the election. A 2017 U.S. intelligence report said that Russia had planned to claim that it was, yes, a stolen election. The report stated, before the election, Russian diplomats had publicly denounced the U.S. electoral process and were prepared to publicly call into question the validity of the results. Pro-Kremlin bloggers had prepared a Twitter campaign, #democracyRIP, on election night, in anticipation of Secretary Clinton's victory, the report said. They were going to drive up divisions that way. As Phil, in episode 1, observed, Russia doesn't influence a country by advocating to it. Russia influences a country by directly changing it. And they improvised and responded to shifting situations.
There's a lot of entrepreneurism in the Russian intelligence landscape that is absolutely absent if you're looking at a Western intelligence structure most of the time. So we don't really work that way. We don't really see it that way. We don't really have independent GRU units that kind of self-fund and come up with ways to contribute to the cause.
Este episodio es presentado por Hill's Pet Nutrition. Cada mascota en adopción merece una segunda oportunidad y tú lo haces posible cada día porque cuando le das Hill's a tu mascota, alimentas a una mascota en adopción, lo que las hace más sanas, felices y más aptas a ser adoptadas, cambiando sus vidas para siempre para que puedan cambiar la tuya. Más de 14 millones de mascotas en refugios alimentadas y adoptadas. Es gracias a la ciencia. Conoce más en hillspet.com/podcast.
In 2016, a gamified version of politics played out on social media, creating new ways to galvanize and reach voters. Just as a storm of synthetic social media posts flooded the election, new technology will offer novel opportunities to exploit. We race to understand the political and social and security implications of cryptocurrency, of quantum computing, of drones, of big data, of artificial intelligence and the deep fake audio that it makes possible.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables, right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
I will tell you this, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be mightily rewarded by our press.
You see the problem. The entrepreneurialism that Molly mentioned about Russian intelligence, it's true about Russia's information war and propaganda, too. a brave new world of for-hire actors. That's what the Internet Research Agency was. Using an intermediary, I found someone else in Russia who had worked at the IRA in St. Petersburg and who was willing to talk.
At first, I did work on writing texts and comments on various sites.
The man, in his 30s, later said using his first name in this podcast shouldn't be a problem. But my Russia expert friends advised me, essentially, don't use his real name.
The comments were on YouTube, the Russian ВКонтакте network. Then I started working on monitoring the press. This was my main task. I even headed a small department, and I had to monitor the press on the political figures in Russia. Because the task was to counteract the opposition media, opposition structures for these projects, forming a certain image of Russian authorities.
Unlike Lyudmila in episode 1, this man worked in the IRA after the 2016 election. He estimates that between 70 and 80% of the Troll Factory's work in its entire lifetime was directed at domestic audiences. He sounds like a reasonable guy, a Russian who's knowledgeable and thoughtful about his world. He was philosophical about the role of the Troll Factory. As for the material the IRA pushed, he says it trafficked in hatred.
If you are not satisfied with something in life then, as I observed other people do, you can channel this hatred and receive money for it.
But that was the model, he said, and it made sense in the Russian sphere.
If you take as a kind of state structure or a structure that works for the state, well, probably this thing is necessary because, of course, the state needs to form a certain image. And such farms help to form a certain image because they work from inside.
And just so casually, he explained something unacceptable, unthinkable in the free world, that governments should get to shape the minds of their own people. The events of 2016 showed that authoritarian governments could target the minds of people outside Russia, people in democracy. The notion that it was a couple of cyber attacks from Russia and a single troll factory in St. Petersburg that caused all this mayhem in the election is false. Those elements don't take into account the wall of noise and chaos that was being generated from the ground up with Russia's help. When you look at the international networks of accounts, the compatriot groups in the US, American-led trolling efforts with a Russian connection, all of these forces converging on the election, and the fact that they all moved in the same direction, like a school of fish, against Clinton, for Trump, but more than anything, against American democracy, it raises the question, what kind of coordination was there? Who would be in a position to wrangle such vastly different groups? It could simply be a matter of getting the right message to sufficiently motivated communities at the right time. This is what we talk about when we talk about interference in the 2016 election. In an open internet, anyone can dip into the conversation. The coordinated interference and influence effort could have been done without the blessing of Donald Trump himself. This could explain how he rode a tailwind of digital disruption into the White House, where chaos ensued for 4 years. That's not to say American voters' motives for backing Trump weren't legitimate, or the frustration with the political status quo wasn't real.
I'm running for president. Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than...
This also doesn't mean Hillary Clinton should have won. Imagine the names of presidents. Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, then another Clinton. The U.S. would look to be ruled by family dynasties, not citizens. Going into 2016, Trump had greater name recognition than any other Republican candidate. But much of what happened in the primaries was a social media-centered effort to discredit a weak field of Republicans, allowing Trump to win. If there was any point to the organized chaos, it was, in retrospect, to get a disbelieving public and resistant Republicans to accept Trump as a political leader. That accounted in part for the surreal nature of the campaign.
USA! 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 USA!
This was at the infamous Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. A white supremacist drove his car through the crowd of the counter-rally, killing a woman and injuring 35 people.
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
And we're going to the Capitol, so let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I want to thank you all. God bless you, and God bless America.
Since 2016, Trump's actions speak for themselves. And after he left office, his grip on the Republicans only tightened. While the real-world suffering caused by Russia increases, most notably after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Meanwhile, it appears that the mental land bridge forged between Russia and certain Americans has grown even stronger. Here is Tucker Carlson on a visit to a Moscow grocery store this year, with another American election underway.
Wrecking people's lives in their country, and that's what our leaders have done to us. And coming to a Russian grocery store, the heart of evil, and seeing what things cost and how people live, it will radicalize you against our leaders. That's how I feel anyway, radicalized. We're not making any of this up, by the way, at all.
Since 2016, we really live in a new world. A bit like how historians saw World War I ushering in the 20th century in earnest, 2016 and the possibilities it brought, well, it ushered in the 21st century in earnest. At the beginning of this podcast, I mentioned how the troll factory undermined the promise of the internet. But really, the year 2016 seemed to mark the end of the promise. The assumption that the internet could foster unity and connection ended quite dramatically. In fact, after that year, there was a lot of talk about weaponizing the internet, weaponizing social media, weaponizing language, weaponizing everything. When you think about it, it wasn't just the fact that what we thought was connecting us could actually divide us. It was the sudden awareness of who was using the internet. Not just certain politicians, but certain regimes. And really, the whole promise of the internet, what inspired its first advocates and commercializers, was based on Western liberal notions. After 2016, it became clear other people with illiberal notions had ideas too. And really, technology doesn't have an ideology. It reflects our priorities. For those of us who value the liberal freedoms of democracy that we've known through the 20th century, we are going to be spending a lot of time reestablishing those freedoms in this new world. If the 20th century is any example, the 21st century won't come without its battles. In fact, you could say that the battle already started. And 2016 was the year it began. Dark Shining Moment is a Ranieri & Co. production, reported and written by me, Chris Sapone. Sound design by Martin Peralta. Executive producer, Greg Mueller. Consulting producer, Richard Baker. And managing producer, Nick Randall. The opening theme is Rainbow Death Revisited by Votaries, courtesy of Wharf Cat Records. Special thanks, Jane Curtis, BJ Bethel, Barney Ellis, Slava Grigoriev, Norman Hermont, Jeff McGann, Siobhan McHugh, Tom McKendrick, Michael McKenzie, Sasha Payne, Tysia Payne, John Schindler, Andrei Shashnikov, Kyle Wilson, and The Age and City Morning Herald. If you'd like to learn more about some of the topics discussed in Dark Shining Moment, follow my work at theage.com.au or my occasional blog at coldwardaily.com. Dark Shining Moment is a Ranieri & Co. original production.